Futurized goes beneath the trends, tracking the underlying forces of disruption in tech, policy, business models, social dynamics, and the environment. Join me, futurist Trond Arne Undheim, PhD author, investor, and serial entrepreneur, as I discuss the societal impact of deep tech such as AI, blockchain, IoT, nanotech, quantum, robotics, and synthetic biology, and tackle topics such as entrepreneurship trends for the future of work. I'm a research scholar in global systemic risk, innovation, and policy at Stanford University. On Futurized, I interview smart people with a soul, founders, authors, executives, and other thought leaders, or even the occasional celebrity. Futurized is a bi-weekly show preparing you to think about how to deal with the next decade's disruption so you can succeed and thrive no matter what happens. Futurized, conversations that matter. If you're new to the show, seek particular topics, or are looking for a great way to tell your friends about the show, we've got the episode categories. Those are at futurized.org/episodes. I am the co-author of Augmented Lean, a human-centric framework for managing frontline operation, and the author of Health Tech, Rebooting Society's Software, Hardware, and Mindset, Future Tech, How to Capture Value from Disruptive Industry Trends, Pandemic Aftermath, How Coronavirus Changes Global Society, The Disruption Games, How to Thrive on Serial Failure, and of Leadership from Below, How the Internet Generation Redefines the Workplace. For an overview, you can go to trondundheim.com/books. At this stage, Futurized is lucky enough to have several sponsors. And to check them out, go to futurized.org/sponsors. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or to get an overview of other services provided by me, including how to book me for keynote speeches, please go to futurized.org/store. We'll consider all brands that have demonstrably positive contributions to the future. Before you do anything else, make sure you are subscribed to our newsletter on futurized.org, where you can find hundreds of episodes of conversations that matter to the future. Please also leave a positive review on iTunes. Thanks so much. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to have you, actually. We're going to talk about this very interesting term that you have contributed to popularizing and developing called epistemic security. And I want to just bring my guests up to speed. So you are this fascinating philosopher slash policy think tank director with this background from philosophy of science and technology from University of Cambridge, and also with a degree in bioethics from UCLA. So those are interesting things.
And accurate facts about me.
Yes. You're currently the director of something called Chasm at Demos, which is a British think tank, bipartisan political think tank in London. And you are working on issues related to misinformation, and we'll get into that. But I wanted to cover a couple of things. So you, I wanted the audience to get a sense of you. Was I correct about the first part?
Yes. Three accurate facts. I have the undergrad in bioethics from UCLA and the PhD in philosophy of science from Cambridge. And I am the director of the digital policy unit called Chasm at the think tank Demos in London. So that's so far.
Three for three. That's a rare one.
Three for three.
Yeah. That's a rare victory. I'll count that. Well, you did share one thing with me, which is kind of unrelated, but I always ask people a fun fact. Why is it that you get the hiccups every time you brush your teeth?
I have no idea, but it cracks my partner up and my mom every time I visit home. And it scares my cat. He looks at me really weirdly.
Do the hiccups end eventually?
They do, almost as soon as I finish brushing my teeth. It's really weird. I start brushing my teeth. You know, I have the electric toothbrush with a little timer on it. And without fail, about 25 to 30 seconds in, I get really intense hiccups and they go until I stop.
You know, I don't know if this is at all related to epistemic security, but I will tell you, maybe this is one of the reasons why we don't act on all kinds of security things, because if the problems go away, we are assuming it's not a problem.
Okay, I was going to say, I don't think my hiccups are like an allegory for the rest of this conversation.
Oh, we'll see. We shall see. I try very hard.
But, every day, twice a day, hiccups.
Yeah. Well, joking aside, and, you know, this is important because we are going, I guess, into an age, and this is partly your argument, where we're going to rely a lot on expertise. But I think expertise and humor, you know, kind of go together also. So it wasn't just a joke. Anyway, tell me about epistemic security. What is this term? And yes, so what does it mean?
The term epistemic security is something that I coined with a team at CSER, so the Center for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge. We worked on a report looking at myths and disinformation. And the term epistemic security we use to refer to that big bundle of problems around myths and disinformation and the challenges that we're having appraising information and producing reliable information. It's really this umbrella term. Epistemology, the root, or episteme, means it means knowledge. So epistemology is the study of knowledge. Epistemic security is thinking about how to secure those systems by which knowledge or information is produced, distributed, evaluated, and used in societies to make decisions, and make decisions collaboratively, whether we're talking about elections, deciding who to vote for, or trying to figure out how to respond to complex challenges like climate change or pandemics. These are all collective decision-making issues, and having reliable information to act on is really important for that. And there's tons of different things that feed into this, but epistemic security is about finding the vulnerabilities in those information producing and distributing systems, and thinking about how we bolster those vulnerabilities.
So I had not read any of your work before you presented and were included in the Stanford Conference on Existential Risk last year and the proceedings there. It was a very interesting piece of paper to read.
Thank you.
I want you to lay out a little bit this the concept, because in that specific paper, you talk about an epistemic security threshold. And I guess the reason that sort of grabs my attention is you're implying that we are perhaps soon close to some sort of threshold that would be consequential in terms of dealing with the risks that you're lining up. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I actually had a lot of fun with this paper. What I was trying to do was really flip the whole issue of epistemic security on its head. I think, you know, there's a lot of debate and arguments around how insecure and terrible our information environments are getting. They're rife with disinformation. We don't know how to evaluate what's true and what's not. And this is really making it hard to make good decisions. And I found that in trying to discuss how bad our epistemic environments are getting, one of the challenges that kept getting brought up, and very rightly so, is that, yeah, our information environments are getting a bit messy, but really in the grand scheme of things, epistemic security is better than it's ever been. You know, we have good science, which produces high quality information, and you know, the internet, it allows access to information and good high quality information at a level never before seen. And so really, like, isn't our epistemic security, our access to good information, high quality information, decision guiding information, isn't that just getting better and better and better? And yeah, we have little issues, but that's on the small scale. And so what's really the problem? And I was thinking about it more deeply, and I thought, well, if we flip this whole issue on the head, maybe the issue is that, yeah, epistemic security is getting a lot better. We have better access to information than ever before. And maybe that trend is flattening out a bit. So let's grant that it's still on the upward trajectory. The other issue is that maybe the level of epistemic security we need in order to effectively respond to the challenges and crises we face today, that threshold level is getting higher, such that even if our information environments are getting richer and more high quality and easier to access, that it's just not enough. and so this concept that I was exploring was around thinking like what those trigger points are. Why is it that we might need better epistemic security than before? And I think there are a few things at play. It could be that the challenges we're facing just require higher levels of coordination, and higher levels of coordination require even better information sources and even more reliable ability to evaluate that information. So think like global climate change, for example. This is a global issue that takes global cooperation for decision making. You don't need global cooperation among billions of people to address, you know, like how you're going to do crop rotations in your little village. So the level of epistemic security needed is quite a bit higher. Same thing like with dealing with global pandemics, which became much more of an issue with globalization and international travel. So that's something that could raise that threshold level of epistemic security we need. Another one is perhaps global convergence on more democratic forms of government. Whereas people might say, well, then the answer is to get rid of democracy. That is not at all what I'm saying. Let's assume democracy is good for the sake of this conversation. But from a very practical standpoint, if coordination and responding to a crisis allows a bunch of individual decision makers to decide for themselves that they're going to do something specific, that's a really hard coordination problem. So like think of the pandemic, for example. If you need billions of people to all decide at the same time that, yes, I'm going to get a vaccine and, yes, I'm going to wear a mask, that's a lot harder problem than being able to have a government that just says you are all required to wear a mask. So again, democracy, good, but a collective decision-making issue here. And so I think that these are the kinds of things that they're raising that threshold. We need better epistemic security to make decisions in the societies we have with the kinds of challenges that we're facing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, on your pandemic example of coordination, I guess that most countries solve this through emergency regulation, which has its own problems, right? Because if it's temporary, it's emergency. But then what's not an emergency? When does it become permanent? So that's one issue. But you even pointed out that autocratic societies actually are, you know, more efficient from that point of view, or they could theoretically in crisis act faster, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, infringing on human rights and like comes with a bunch of other...
Comes
with a price. But if you're... And I think the angle that I was taking in this paper, and, you know, by necessity, when you're limited to 3,000 words, you you narrow your angle quite a bit. But I was specifically looking at the levels of epistemic security we need in order to respond to other kinds of crises and challenges. And so purely from that perspective, you know, you could think of more of an autocratic society. They, you know, potentially they don't need that higher level of epistemic security. That epistemic security threshold might be lower from a purely coordination standpoint. Again, not saying we should go for autocratic societies, just the nature of the beast. I think what I was doing is I was thinking there are two ways that epistemic security itself could be considered a priority topic of research for people concerned with existential risk. One way is that epistemic security itself gets so bad that we're faced with an existential crisis. And I call this epistemic babble, this situation in which nobody can distinguish truth from fiction, and we're all just running around like chickens with our heads cut off, and that's a terrible existence. Let's call that an existential crisis. The other way, which I think is much more likely, is that small bits of degradation to epistemic security put us in a situation where we just have a really hard time responding to other crises that truly are catastrophic, like making it really hard to respond to a pandemic, or making it really hard to respond to climate change, or vote for leaders, and then we see the disintegration of democracy and stuff like this. So yeah, coming at it purely from a how epistemic security impacts our ability to respond to crisis. At least that's the angle I took on this paper. But a fun exercise in turning the whole question on its head.
Well, a fun exercise indeed. I was perplexed and kind of amazed at the style that you used. Only because, you know, if you write an empirical paper, you need to sort of prove evidence in terms of like how this is moving through the centuries. You had these wonderful graphs where you were.
They're totally hand-drawn.
Bracketing facts in the sense that you were kind of making some enormous assumptions, but then you had some curves that had ups or downs over an enormous span of time.
Oh, yeah.
That was fascinating because you are in your full right to argue, you know, in a formal way, but then you introduced, you know, curves there. It was a sneaky little move. It was effective.
Thank you. Yeah, so actually a fun story in how this paper came about. It really did start out as just like genuinely a fun exercise in trying to flip this argument on its head and think about epistemic security beyond just how bad is our information for my environment, and thinking like, what other challenges does this pose? I was writing it up as like a maybe blog post. That's where I was going with it. And and then I saw this call for papers for the Stanford Existential Risk Conference, and it just seemed to fit right in. And I reached out and said, I was like, hey, I have this paper draft, sort of blog posty paper draft thing. I'm really not interested in making it more robust, because I honestly don't know how to go about doing that. This is one of the big issues with studying epistemic security, is like, how do you measure how robust an information ecosystem is? What are the metrics you use? And then even once you define those metrics, like, I don't have an empirical background. I am not the person to do that research. So I came to Stanford. I was just like, I have this really interesting idea. I don't want to be more robust about it. Would you be interested in even just like putting this out as like a blog post type thing attached to your conference? And they read it and they were like, no, this is just a really cool idea and we want it out there. And so they took it, hand-drawn graphs and all.
No, I mean, I wasn't actually criticizing. I was just pointing out that sometimes, I mean, I was part of that team that said it.
Okay.
So, but there's something about the visualization and the glaring, I guess, elegance of the term. I'm really curious what other feedback you've had around this term. I shared with you that I had heard a little bit good feedback from various circles, and so that sort of suggests that the term is now making its turns, at least around kind of the futurist circles.
Yeah. So there's also been some negative feedback around the term that I think is very well placed. and it's concern around the securitization of information ecosystems. So security is a term that is used and implemented when we feel under threat. And it's a term used to often justify actions, activities, policy decisions that would normally not be considered acceptable under normal circumstances. A lot of things are done in the name of security that would otherwise be seen as breaches of human right or invasions of privacy. And so I think there's a genuine concern about thinking of the security of our information ecosystems and needing to build that security and protect that security as potentially justifying things like mass censorship. Or actually, that's just a good example. I'm going to stop there. But like this, like, could it be used as a justification for that? Do we make our information systems secure by censoring what people are saying, by preventing people from voicing opinions, or by squelching minority voices? And so I think that's a genuine concern. I think there are also a lot of benefits to the security framing. Specifically, it makes it something tangible. I think it points to a methodology. It says here, we have something we can analyze. We have our broad information ecosystems. We have different points along the production and dissemination, distribution and evaluation of information where people can run into different vulnerabilities. Maybe it has to do with the technology we're using to produce the information. Maybe it has to do with the education that's available to help people appraise the quality of information that they're receiving. We can find these vulnerabilities and we can deploy solutions to try and patch those vulnerabilities. So I don't think it's necessarily that like, oh, this is a bad term. I think it's just very important to be aware of the shortcoming and make sure that we don't step over that line into securitization where we start justifying actions that are not good actions to justify. My eloquence just went down the drain.
No, that's perfect. So tell me more about securitization. Yes, I see that. I see that problem. So that's something that has increasingly happened across the entire existential risk, or really any other risk space. Is that you know, it's either sort of, I guess, ignored by decision makers on the militaristic or sort of the legal side of things, or it is embraced. But yes, with this rationale that, well, now that it is important to us, we want to control it. But in some ways, you can't have one without the other. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think that there's truth to that. You know, depending if it's urgent enough to slap it with that security framing, then in a sense you are handing over some of the freedoms. So I think there's truth to that, which then opens the question, is it urgent enough to slap with the security framing? And again, that's a really hard question to answer. I think
how would you answer it, Elizabeth? What is the urgency of epistemic security? Because you pointed out early in this conversation and in your paper that, you know, basically the situation might have gotten better for a good while here. And then there are there's two threats that I see, right? There's either the threat that the world has become more complex. There's, some recent work on polycrisis, and there's obviously a lot of work on existential risks. And they're either saying there's more crises and they're all working together in various ways, the idea of cascading risks that I work on, or they're saying, you know, there's some individual risks that just are detrimental, you know, starting with nuclear risk and now with AI risk and perhaps with synthetic biology and bio risks, sort of lab releases and stuff. So there's at least three individual risk areas that are very, very serious. But there's also this idea, I guess, that, so you said, you know, if you need more epistemic control or a higher level of expertise in the population to handle something, that's one issue. The other is if some of these developments, technologies, or other social dynamics are detrimental to trust generally, right? And that's the whole misinformation debate. Where are we on that scale? I mean, is that for you a significant worry? Yeah. There's now a lot of work on misinformation.
Yeah, it's a hot topic right now. this is a worry for me, and one of the main areas I'm working on right now is thinking about threats that AI, particularly generative AI, poses to democracy, and also upcoming elections. part of me doesn't like talking about it because I feel like everyone's talking about it.
But that is your day job, though. So yeah, but
it's literally my day job, though. I work for Demos. We're concerned with issues around threats to democracy and upholding democratic values, putting people at the heart of policy. So when there are perceived threats to democracy, we dig in and we tackle it. But I think that there's some really interesting conversations actually around threats being posed to democracy by AI. There's the really obvious threat mechanism, which is people worried about generative AI being used to produce deep fakes of politicians, showing them doing or saying things that they didn't do or say, and then changing people's minds about who to vote for, or disinformation about voting locations and time, so people don't show up to vote. So there's that disinformation aspect, just the very clear, straight cut, changing people's minds about things or confusing people. I'm more concerned about the systemic impacts on trust and democracy more generally. And I think you go two ways with this. By muddying the waters, putting a lot of disinformation out there, or even just talking a lot about how much disinformation is going to be out there generated by AI, you disintegrate trust that people have in their own abilities to evaluate information, to distinguish between what's true and what's not. And when people feel uncomfortable about their own abilities to evaluate information, they often stop engaging with the information. They don't, they just won't go out to vote because they don't know what to do. Or they turn inwards and they just look towards their little isolated communities that hold the similar values that they can turn to for information, and they tend to believe those groups.
So this is the echo chamber debate.
Yeah, this is the echo chamber. So the other thing that happens, though, is so we have disintegration in people's trust in themselves to evaluate information. You have disintegration of trust in the wider information environments. And then you have disintegration of trust in democracy as a whole. And this is the disintegration of trust or people's loss of faith in the ability of democracy to weather the storm. And this is partially to do with the technologies that we're facing, but I think it also has a lot to do with the way that we're talking about the technologies. I mean, you just Google AI impacts on elections and go to your Google News feed, and you'll get like 10 pages of every single news outlet having these, you know, with scary headlines, you know, AI undermines democracy, the way AI is going to crumble democracy, you know, all these headlines. And I think it's really important to report on the issue so people are aware of the technologies that are out there. But I think there's also this sense of impending doom that's coming up where people are just not sure that democracy is going to weather the AI storm in the year 2024. And so I think there's a cautionary tale to be told there. And you can even take it a step further and think of, you know, what'll happen after the elections. I think there's a real chance that the presence of deepfakes, or particularly influential deepfakes, could be used to try and overturn election results or challenge election results, especially in smaller constituency, like more local elections, saying like, not a valid result, there is this deepfake, it's skewed. Like, where's the precedent for this? How do we measure what the impact of a deepfake was on elections? And I think we need to get some like really clear standards around measuring impact of disinformation on elections so that when these challenges are made, we can make a decision about it. Yes, it's a legit challenge. No, it's not. And move on. Because I think there could be a real detriment to trust in democracy if we just start seeing challenges willy-nilly all over the place. But these are just like, there's so many really interesting and deep ways AI can impact democracy. One really important point I want to end with, though, is that oftentimes when talking about the impacts of AI on democracy and our information ecosystems, we're talking as if democracy and our information ecosystems before AI were some pristine, beautiful thing that worked like a well-functioning, well-oiled machine that we now need to preserve. This is not the case. Democracy has been in trouble. There are deep societal issues underpinning flaws in democracy, and this is coming from distrust in politicians, rising hot costs of living, and just this societal unrest and distrust and dissatisfaction is really crumbling and sort of undercutting democracy. And these issues added by AI are icing on the cake. It might be quite thick icing in some places, but it is another layer. And so I just wanted to leave with that point.
Well, let me probe just one more thing around this AI point, though. You also work on open source, right? This very specific aspect of whether aspects of AI models should be public or not public. And I guess the argument could be laid out that, you know, generally, transparency of information is good for democracy. But specifically, in the case of AI, the particular information we're talking about disclosing could be used for such nefarious purposes and possibly couldn't be put back into the bag that it becomes an issue. What is your view on open sourcing advanced AI models or foundational models for AI?
Yeah. So my view on open sourcing AI in general is net good, probably good in the vast majority of cases. I think we need to be cautious, though, about what's happening at the frontier. And when I talk about frontier AI, I really just mean the systems that are at that cutting edge frontier. I generally don't like the term frontier AI because people use it to just mean highly capable, but the frontier moves. So I think that we need to be careful about what's happening on the frontier, because we see new emergent capabilities that we didn't expect that pop up in different application spaces. Because like you said, once you open source a model, specifically open sourcing the weights, you can't put that back in the bag. They're out there. And there are concerns about potentially extreme risks that could be posed by future AI systems around mis and disinformation being used for influence operations, being used to create biological and chemical weapons, malware and cyber attacks. And, you know, there are recent papers that I think very rightfully point out that current evidence shows that it's just very minimal marginal risk that's added by these systems to these based on what we could do before these systems existed. I think, however, that we need to we need to recognize that it is feasible. We could conceivably one day produce a system that we do not want to be open sourced. And I think that most people wouldn't disagree with that.
So you have more in mind the fact that this is so emergent that if we start making lines in the sand right now on this high horse of like open democracy, then we might actually be shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah. It's moving quickly. We don't know what the horizon holds. And if we can just, you know, recognize that we could feasibly one day create something, we don't want to be open sourced. Then we
Elizabeth, but have you seen true emergent capabilities right now, 2024? Can you point to anything that is an emergent capability? And, you know, maybe you want to define that for me because it's a very unclear term.
It is a very unclear term. I'm not even going to try and define it, honestly. I don't think it's worth it. Maybe emergent capability is not even the angle to take on this. More like, I think people are just, they're concerned about the more significant risks that could be posed by AI systems put in the wrong hands. And I think that it isn't acceptable to acknowledge that these risks might be well-founded and that we could one day have a systems that we don't want to open source. And that we should very at least be prepared, having systems, policies, procedures in place for identifying those systems and making a decision. So, for example, there was a lot of backlash around Meta making the decision to open source Llama 2. I use the term open source very, very loosely in this respect, just to mean publicly accessible. I don't care personally that Llama 2 is out there. I think it's probably great that Llama 2 is out there in general. The issue is that there was no process in place for making that decision. There was no clear, transparent process. What steps were taken? How do we know that that was a safe decision? I'm sure Meta has its own internal procedure or thought process that it went through to some extent. You know, but you talk about the values of transparency. Let's be transparent about those processes and maybe have them subject to public scrutiny. And this is where we come into this discussion around not just democratizing AI for everyone to use and you know to have in their pocket and to contribute to the development, but actually democratizing the governance processes. You know, these are potentially high stakes decisions being made.
Yeah, and I think now we're at the core of what you were saying earlier about democracy, right? Because it's one thing to say, well, you know, democracy has this one isolated problem of security, but what you're saying is these large companies are already, mostly through their own volition or the evolution of technology, they're in charge of such significant decisions that in the past, in any human past, these decisions would have been taken or at least attempted grabbed by, you know, either elites or, you know, communities that said, well, this is a collective decision. You know, you have no business, you know, you're controlling this X farm resource, but, you know, this is now something we all care about. We're going to decide, you know, at town meeting. And that hasn't happened yet for these technologies.
Yeah. And I think this is where open source communities are coming from when they're calling for these large language models to be open source. And they're seeing that as, you know, this is really important for making sure it's not just in the hands of these big companies. We can all benefit from it, contribute to the development, distribute these systems for people to use and modify for specific applications and needs. And that's one way of democratizing the technology. But it's not just about democratizing the technology in terms of democratizing access. So it's not just in terms of democratizing access for development and use, but it's about democratizing the high stakes decisions as well. It's about democratizing the governance of those decisions. And so a lot of times you hear this, you know, people will say like, oh, we're open sourcing in the name of democracy, in the name of the democratization of AI. And the argument will be, you know, these big tech companies, they're not democratically elected. We should put AI in the hands of the people for people to control and use and distribute the benefit. And that's all well and good. But there is a slight irony in this, in that you're making high stakes decisions that could potentially have huge impact on the world for good or for bad, being made by a completely unelected entity. So I think, like, I like to take this concept of democratization and really deconstruct it. And I think there's four kinds of democratization for AI. There's the democratization of use, there's the democratization of development, there's the democratization of the benefits or profits. You can distribute the profits of AI to wider communities without distributing the model itself. And then there's the democratization of the governance decisions. And that's when you can start thinking about how can wider communities input the governance decisions of the models? How can corporate governance structures be more democratic? And how can policymaking around AI be more democratic and respond to community needs?
Yeah, I mean, these are big issues. So what are your suggestions to, I guess, either reduce the time lag before enough people realize what the issues are around their supposed epistemic sort of insecurities, or are there other ways that you think this needs to happen?
So pivoting back to the epistemic security conversation then, and the disinformation, misinformation, there's no silver bullet. I think that's probably the main takeaway. There isn't like a key solution. I think we're going to need a multi-pronged approach. It's going to take, companies that control AI systems and social media platforms to think about what technical solutions can be put forward. This might be watermarking content provenance, better recommendation algorithms. So I think there's technical solutions we need to think about. There's also how people, particularly with the upcoming elections, how politicians and election campaigns use these new technologies. I think we're too close to the deadline to make good policy on this front. I wouldn't want to rush to make policy, but I think we can go quite a long way with setting some good norms around good behavior during elections using AI.
Which deadline are you talking about in this case?
I'm just saying, like, we have upcoming elections in 2024. If we wanted to try and get policy around, like, how...
Oh, sure. But I mean, you always have upcoming elections somewhere around the world. There are some consequential ones.
There are some big consequential, concentrated, lots of different countries all experiencing elections at the same time. Yeah. There's just a lot of hype around impacts of AI on election right now. And I wouldn't want to respond to that hype by rushing through bad policy, is what I'm saying. But I think that this is a good time to start setting some norms around how generative AI is used in election campaigns. And that might come from having commitments from politicians or political parties around how certain technologies are going to be used. Obviously, this is also not the silver bullet. We still have huge issues with like external international actors running influence campaigns, and that won't have, commitments from political campaigns won't have any effect on that. I think another angle to take is thinking about digital literacy. How are we going to educate people about how to interact with the new technologies? What should they expect to see during upcoming elections? How do they evaluate the information they have? I think, throughout history, we went from an era pre-internet where education was about teaching how to memorize. And then we had an era of teaching how to find information. And now we're in the era of how to evaluate information. And we need to shift the educational structure like that. My one pet peeve is when people put all the pressure on digital literacy, though, and say, like, we just need to improve digital literacy. And I generally think that's a bad idea, because it's basically taking the most vulnerable population and saying it's your responsibility to make sure this AI epistemic security thing goes well. It's a multi-pronged approach, and we need lots of different actors involved.
Elizabeth, you remind me of something I wanted to ask you, because so often in these misinformation debates, everyone talks about the news media. And but with AI, one of the, shocking things for me is that it's as much challenge as the knowledge worker and the smart expert as it does challenge the sort of information poor at the lowest end of the pyramid. I have felt personally quite challenged by some of these technologies. They challenge, they go to the core of what you think you know, right? And then there's this argument of, you know, augmentation. So we're all scrambling to find the best ways to use the technology to act smarter and research more and better. But it does actually go to the core even of creative work, right? One of the paradoxical challenges is that generative AI is actually pretty good at creative work, and it's pretty good at combinatory information, and it's good at, you know, a lot of intelligence tasks. This is really unsettling for the elite. So what would you say at the upper echelon of society, what's happening there with regards to epistemic security? I mean, at the state level, you know, this could get states worried about, you know, AI flipping the power balance of powers at the, you know, at the highest levels. It could get the elite worried about, you know, how long are we going to remain the elite for, you know, whether it's a financial or intellectual elite. What do you have to say about that in terms of this epistemic security situation?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, in terms of saying like this is a technology that's impacting everyone, I think that's such a good point. You know, other technological revolutions that we've seen, like you know, the printing press, or not the printing press, not that example, but like looms, bringing looms in, this great machine that can weave things quickly. You know, that didn't impact everyone. That was a certain class of workers that were disrupted. But now we have this technology that's just, it's impacting everyone across the board. And you know, I've found this too. Like I was, as one does, flipping through Twitter and saw I think it was a video of Rishi Sunak giving some speech, explaining something on a whiteboard. And my immediate reaction was, well, this could probably just be a fake. And then I clicked on it, did some digging, and it was like, you know, it was put out by the Conservative Party and everything. And I was like, okay, no, this has like actually been put out by the party. It's probably not a fake. But my immediate reaction was, well, I can't trust this. I'm like, that's not good for society. but in terms of like flipping of power or imbalancing power, I don't know. Like, it's a really interesting tool. Like you said, it's putting amazing capabilities in the hands of such a large number of people all across society. I don't know. So one thing I think about though is like, you know, we talk about how transformative this technology is going to be for jobs and for public services. And I don't want to be a naysayer, but it's I don't know. I think about like how it's impacted my work so far and how it's impacted public services so far and other people's jobs. It's like, have we really seen AI unleash its potential and improvements on productivity on work markets yet? I'm not saying it won't, but I don't think like we're not quite realizing it yet. A lot of proof of concept stuff. So I think that might still be a bit further down the line. In terms of like flipping power and redistributing power, my main concern, at least in the nearer term, is how it's redistributing power, possibly like away from politicians towards big tech. And I think this is another one of those threads that might be undermining faith or trust in democracy, is this idea that the power no longer really resides with the elected officials. It's going to reside with the controllers of this massively financially lucrative and pervasive technology. And if that's where the power resides, then it's sort of like, well, what's democracy for? Who are we voting for? What are they doing when the most impactful decisions on our lives, on society, on our public services, on our jobs are going to be made by a handful of tech controllers? So I think, like, at least in the near term, that's the change in power dynamic that I'm worried about. I hope that maybe that answers.
No, that was pretty clear. And it relates to, I guess, my next question, last question, because we, you know, I want to wrap this up. There are so many things that come to mind, but in terms of what's next in, you know, in the field that you're working on, so let's call it epistemic security for now. In the next decade, is that a worrying time frame, or are you even, well, you were just talking about 2024, you think that, or at least a lot of people are worried about this election year in and of itself, but if you just look a little bit longer, so 3 to 5 years, up to a decade, what do you think should happen? What could happen? What do you fear? What do you hope?
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with how the technology is going to develop. And that's largely speculative. I mean, some people still do believe in like really strong compute trends and saying, you know, capability will increase with the amount of compute we throw at these things. And we've been seeing that happen. But we're also seeing like there can be, you know, we can fine tune systems to have really great capability at lower compute thresholds. There's concern that we might plateau in capability. Maybe, you know, I've even heard rumblings like, okay, maybe this approach to just throwing more data at a system to build these foundation models is actually not the way that's going to get us to true general artificial intelligence. And we need to change methods. So the answer is like, we don't know exactly how this technology is going to develop. And so that's going to have large impact on what kind of consequences we see in 3 to 5 years. I think if we do assume that we're going to continue to have increasing capabilities, then I think like what I hope for the next few years is that we work towards some better international coordination on AI regulation. I think a lot of the regulation that's happening in the EU, in the US, and in the UK, it won't be functional on small jurisdictional approaches, especially if you talk about open sourcing. Open sourcing is one of these things like it really doesn't matter if like the UK nails open source policy. It's open source. You know, anyway, like if someone in the US open sources a system that is available to the world. So I have a lot of hope for seeing more international coordination. That's my main hope for the future in the next 3 to 5 years. And we'll have to respond to where the technology goes. But I think cooperation between industry and governments too, more information sharing so we can have a heads up could be really great too. I know that this is some of the work that the AI safety institutes in the UK and the US are doing, is working with companies to do model evaluations and have insights to these model capabilities before release. I think it's a good start.
Well, I want to thank you for this discussion. Certainly, it is a fascinating construct that you've been working on. It was fascinating to think about, and I think it holds great both promise, I guess, and certain risk for the future, both the, like you said, the concept of securitization of such a fundamental aspect of humanity as is, you know, epistemic, production or knowledge mm-hmm. production. It's a massive part of, you know, presumably what keeps us sane and human and developing, but also within, you know, constraints and, you know, in philosophy. Imagine if thought control was imposed, among the old Greeks, we'd probably not where we are right now. If there was too yeah. strong epistemic security control on Aristotle, right?
Yes, very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for bringing this concept to life and for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You have just listened to another episode of the Futurized podcast with me, Trond Arne Undheim, futurist, scholar, and author. If you are interested in my products or services, feel free to check out futurized.org/store, where you can book a keynote speech, become a sponsor or partner, request a podcast swap, or buy a few of my books, such as Augmented Lean, Health Tech, Future Tech, Pandemic Aftermath, Disruption Games, or Leadership from Below. If you're interested in any or all of my projects, check out my website, trondundheim.com, which has links to other podcasts as well as my public appearances. Thank you. Please share this show with those you care about. To find us on social media is easy. We are Futurized on LinkedIn and YouTube, and Futurized2 on Instagram and Twitter. See you next time. Futurized, conversations that matter.